Some say that Christians should never be depressed. They clearly don't read the Psalms. Christians get depressed. And spiritual depression is something that many great Christians and, well, lesser known Christians have all struggled with. And Psalm 143 testifies that depression of spirit is real in the Christian life. So let's read through Psalm 143 again. And it says, a psalm of David. By the way, I'll just make a note here now. The Greek translation, which Jesus and the apostles were reading, they were reading from the Greek one, not the Hebrew one. It has a psalm of David, then it adds, when he was running from Absalom, his son. So it gives a little more context, whether that's, you know, I don't know why the Hebrew doesn't say that, so I don't know if it's just added later, but that's what it says. Verse 1, listen, O Lord, to my prayer. Turn your ear to my appeal. You are faithful. You are just. Give answer. Do not call your servant to judgment, for no one is righteous in your sight. The foe has pursued my soul. He has crushed my life to the ground. He has made me dwell in darkness like those long dead. Therefore, my spirit fails. My heart is desolate within me. I remember the days that are past. I ponder all your works. I muse on what your hand has wrought. And to you, I stretch out my hands. My soul is like a parched land before you. And if we take the Selah to mean verse 1, then we read verse 1. Listen, O Lord, to my prayer. Turn your ear to my appeal. You are faithful. You are just. Give answer. O Lord, make haste and answer me, for my spirit fails within me. Do not hide your face from me, lest I become like those going down to the pit. But in the morning, let me hear your loving mercy. For in you I place my trust. Make me know the way I should walk. To you I lift up my soul. Rescue me, O Lord, from my foes. To you have I fled for refuge. Teach me to do your will, for you are my God. Let your good spirit guide me upon ground that is level. Lord, save my life for the sake of your name. In your justice, lead my soul out of distress. In your mercy, make an end of my foes. Destroy all those who oppress my soul, for I am your servant. A wonderful dedication at the end there, for I am your servant. Charles Spurgeon suffered tremendously from depression of spirit. He preached on it frequently and spoke of it often. Here are some of the ways that he spoke of it in his writings and his sermons. He said, the worst cloud of all is deep depression of spirit. Another place, the worst ill in the world is a depressed spirit. And another, of all things in the world to be, dreaded despair is the chief. He also said, depression is the shadow of death, and depression is my horror of great darkness. To Spurgeon, depression wasn't what we will often describe depression as in a very kind of day-to-day casual way. To him, it wasn't dullness, inertia, pessimism, or deep unhappiness. But it was to feel forsaken by God. That's what he meant by deep spiritual depression. The feeling that God is not there, that he has somehow abandoned or forsaken you. He said, to be forsaken of God is the worst ill that the most melancholy saint ever dreams of. In other words, what is a Christian's worst nightmare? To feel forsaken by God. That's how much Spurgeon cherished an intimacy with Christ day to day. That if he did not feel that, he was in the depth of darkness. I wonder, it makes you wonder, doesn't it? How much of our low spirits come from this gnawing sense that we should have more life, but we're not walking with Christ day by day or keeping him in mind? Now, notice I've been terming this spiritual depression because there is clinical depression. And I have no studies on what that's about. And I would never deem or dare to say that people should not need medication if that's been prescribed. I am not on one fence or the other about that. I have no place to say. I am a theologian. I am not a doctor. So, but I can say that spiritual depression is real. And it could be that we overdiagnose sometimes as physical matters, which might be spiritual. But that's not to negate physical matters either. The feeling of God's absence. So this happens in one of the most beloved allegories written, The Pilgrim's Progress. John Bunyan does a wonderful job at capturing this essence of the depression of spirit. And in fact, the way he describes the story, this part of The Pilgrim's Progress, it seems to evoke a lot of the imagery from Psalm 143. And I'll let you guys pick up on that if you want to. But this is toward the end of Christian's journey, and Hopeful is with him. And they stray off of the path a little bit because there's a big rainstorm and they're afraid. So they stray off the path a little bit and seek shelter. They fall asleep and they wake up and discover, because the big thudding footsteps of giant despair comes, and they discover that they have trespassed his grounds. And so he seizes them and he throws them into a very dark dungeon within his castle. And this is what it says. It says, there they lay in this dark dungeon. There they lay from Wednesday until Saturday night without food or water, and without a ray of light or anyone to console them. They're in darkness, no food, no water, no light, no one to console them. This is a very, very, like in an allegory, you need to read this as more than physical problems. So he said from Wednesday to Saturday. So Wednesday is when they're captured, they're thrown in. And then their misery increases with each passing morning. So the story goes that on Thursday morning, Giant Despair took his knotted club and beat them like sheep-killing dogs. And so it says, then he fell upon them and beat them severely, and they were helpless to resist or ward off his blows. Then he left them in the dark to pity themselves and mourn in agony. They spent the whole day sighing and groaning. One thing we don't see Psalm 143 do is invite you to pity yourself. It doesn't do that. It invites the soul to seek God out of the pity. Then Friday morning comes, and Giant Despair advised them to take their own lives since rescue was hopeless. But they refused to do so. And so he promised them that they will wish they had never been born. And Christian was so fearful of the threat that he actually began to consider Giant Despair's option to take their own lives. But then Hopeful encourages him by doing what? He encourages him by doing what this psalm says in verse 5. I remember the days that are past. I ponder all your works. I muse on what your hand has wrought. He tells Christian about all the ways God has delivered him on the journey. And then he says, I'm with you. And he says this, you see, Christian, I am in this dungeon too, a far weaker person by nature and experience than you, receiving the same punishment and suffering the same agony. The giant has wounded me and has also cast off bread and water from my mouth. And along with you, I mourn without the light. Here's what happens. The Christian feels all this and he's wondering what is going to happen. I'm going to give up. But Hope comes alongside and says, I'm here with you. I'm going through this too. So that's what happens on Friday. Then Saturday morning rolls around, and Giant Despair takes them out of prison and takes them and shows them a mound of bones and skulls of the prisoners that he has conquered. And he says, "This will happen to you too, unless you take my advice." And then he beats them back into the prison, and there they lay all day Saturday in a deplorable condition. Wow, they have it tough, right? This is Giant Despair. And despair is really, one of the ways to look at despair is it's your spiritual form of depression. That's kind of how Christians, how the Bible talks about spiritual depression is you are in despair. You're despairing for your life. Psalm 143, thus, can be seen as a cry to God from the dungeon of Giant Despair. This is what perhaps they would have been crying out. And this is a prayer we should cry out when we are in the dungeon of Giant Despair. Now, before we go forward, I do want to put a little footnote here. Because one of the challenges of preaching Psalms is that it's all too easy to limit the scope of a psalm to what you're preaching on. Please understand this. Psalm 143 is not only a prayer for despair. It is more than that. But this is an angle that we'll be looking at tonight. Does that make sense? So this is not like, well, I'm not in despair. I'm not going to pray Psalm 143. Oh, no, please. This is one of the bummers also about preaching the Psalms is sometimes you can preach it a certain way and then people are like, okay, this is how we got to see it. And you only see it that way forever when the Psalms need to be experienced. You need to be praying them and letting them teach you and show you the way. And you'll find that Psalms have layers upon layers when you're willing to pray them. So please do not limit Psalm 143 to what we'll talk about tonight. But this is what we'll talk about tonight because you can't say everything, right? And you guys are like, amen, please don't. Okay. So Psalm 143 tonight is going to be a cry from the dungeon of Giant Despair. For example, we see in verse 3, the word pursued in this translation. The foe has pursued my soul. The verb here means to be behind, to follow after, to persecute. So I think actually the Old King James translated this, the foe persecutes my soul. But think of that, to follow behind, to come after, it's like stalking. It's like what a mountain lion does to its prey. And one translation actually just full on colorfully called this hunted. The foe has hunted my soul. I think that's graphic. And that really just puts the urgency into place there. Do you ever feel like your soul is hunted? Do you realize that it is? That the foe, the enemy, the demons, the devil, they are seeking, Peter says, someone to devour. You are hunted. And one of the ways that we are hunted is through low spirits and low moods and depression of spirit. And then it says, he has crushed my life to the ground. Notice how Giant Despair beat our pilgrims in the story. And this is what they'll do. They'll crush you. They'll hit you with blow after blow. The subtle thing about spiritual warfare is it's not always being hit in the face. You're being hunted from behind because the enemy does not want to be detected. So he will get you with one nip at a time, right? It's like a dog dogging your heels, they say. Dogging your heels and just nipping at your cloak, if you will, as it follows behind. And just tear after tear, you don't even realize how much it's unraveling until you're cold, until you're naked, right? This is how they hit us. They crush us, but not instantly. There's a game that we play at Thousand Pines for the kids. It's called Predator Prey, and I could not help but think of this game when we're looking at being hunted and being crushed by the enemy, because this game is kind of terrifying on my part. So what I'm supposed to do is it's our ecology hike, which is to teach the kids about like the way animals eat animals and the circle of life kind of a thing. And so what we then play is a game called Predator Prey. And guess who is the predator and guess who is the prey? I'm the prey. And they are all the predators. And what we do is I go up this hill. about, I don't know, about 100 feet up, and it's a slight incline. So I'm up there, and I'm hidden behind some cedars. It's this nice school of, like, little cedar saplings, so there's lots of, like, of those to hide behind for the kids. And so what they have to do is they have to come up and stalk me, and literally have to stalk me. I will count, and while I'm counting, my eyes are closed, so the kids know that they can move. But when I'm done counting, my eyes open, and if I see them, they have to go back to the bottom of the hill and start over. So they all have to, like, learn to sneak up on me and not be seen. It's like hide and seek and green light, red light all at the same time. It's a blast. They love it. And I'm standing there, and what's terrifying is, like, you can start to hear them when they're closer. Like, as you're counting with your eyes closed, you start to hear the bushes around you ruffling. And then, like, when you, sometimes you hear them from behind you. And I'm standing on a stump, right? I'm standing on a stump, and I hear people behind me on my right, on my left, coming up. And, like, I'm trying to honor them and not cheat, and I'm going to keep my eyes closed. But, like, you hear, you just, like, wonder if one of them's just going to bolt out the next time I count. And just, like, you know, like, disorienting with your eyes closed, a little tag could throw me off. And so it's just that feeling of being besieged and hunted, and you can do nothing but stand there. I get the feeling. But here's the power, right? It's to have your eyes open. I can send them all back with my eyes open. And this is one of the things a Christian must learn, is the battle's real. You are hunted, so keep your eyes open. The foe does not want to be detected. His stealth is his weapon. We keep our eyes open, and the Bible often associates prayer with keeping watch. And when the church in the past has talked about vigils, that means praying through the night. This is what you do. You pray through the watches of the night. That's, I mean, you don't have to do that, right? But the idea is that in your life, you keep prayerful. You keep watch so you can see the foe. I thought that was a powerful image in my mind this week. So verse 4. Goes on and says, therefore my spirit fails. Oh, I assume you guys can see, by the way, the end of verse 3. He's made me dwell in darkness like those long dead. Like, that's just the feeling of depression of spirit. But verse 4, therefore my spirit fails. The verb indicates, fails, it indicates growing weak. So it's this idea of, like, you're losing something, right? Like a tire losing air. In fact, literally that's depression, right? You're lose or deflating, I guess. Depression and deflation have a lot in common. There's this oozing out of your energy, of your life, of your hope. And one translation colorfully puts this word fails as draining away. Therefore, my spirit drains away. Isn't that graphic? The New King James has it as overwhelmed. And that's the idea of, like, just being besieged. You're just overwhelmed by what's happening. So you're sinking under, overwhelmed, right? And then we come to the next line of verse 4. My heart is desolate within me. Desolate. That's a word that's, like, we know it's, like, a bad word. I don't mean, like, a naughty word, but, like, a word that's bad for us. But sometimes you have to hear, like, its synonyms to really grasp how bad desolate is. And so the Hebrew can also translate this word desolate as being appalled or stunned. You're appalled at what's happening, or you're stunned by what's happening. One of the translations that one scholar who translates the Psalms, Robert Alter, actually translate this stunned. Therefore, my spirit is stunned. Maybe deserted is another way to look at this. My spirit is deserted. It's abandoned. That's what desolate means. Like, you're wasted and empty is what desolate refers to. So you're deserted. You're left alone. I think that's how the New English, I don't remember what translation put it that way. The Message sometimes colorfully helps. And it says, he translates desolate as heavy like lead. My spirit is heavy like lead. And that's actually how the people in Charles Spurgeon's day talked about depression of spirit. He talked about a heaviness of spirit. Like, it's just weighed down and cannot move forward. So this is what we're getting painted for us. We just see in those verses there, the condition, the feeling that the heart is going under in this prayer. And then this depression of spirit climaxes in verse 7 when we see that he feels forsaken by God. There's a feeling of being forsaken by God. So the Abbey, which I'm reading from, puts it, O Lord, make haste and answer me. for my spirit fails within me. That theme comes back of failing. Do not hide your face from me, lest I become like those going down to the pit. If you don't show up, I'm dead. He feels forsaken. Other translations just kind of color it in so you can kind of get the feeling of this. The Message puts it, again, I don't find The Message as a good study Bible, but I think sometimes it can just color in the black and white for us. Hurry with your answer, God. I'm nearly at the end of my rope. Don't turn away. Don't ignore me. Don't ignore me. That would be certain death. The New English Translation, which is quickly becoming a beloved one for a lot of people, says, answer me quickly, Lord. My strength is fading. Do not reject me, or I will join those descending into the grave. Forsaken. Have you ever felt forsaken by God? Have you ever felt that he's not hearing or that he's not on your side or that he's just somehow letting you go through something and it shouldn't happen? It shouldn't be going that way. Good news. Jesus felt that way too. You know what he cried on the cross? Matthew 27:45. I'm going to start with the verse before it because it pictures the darkness theme. Now from the sixth hour, that's noon, there was darkness over all the land until the ninth hour, 3 p.m. And about the ninth hour, Jesus cried out with a loud voice, saying, Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani, that is, my God, why have you forsaken me? Now, he's citing the first line of Psalm 22, which is always how you reference the Psalms. Now, our modern translations like to put titles on the top of them, and that's cute and helpful to find things. But ancient-wise, you always refer to a psalm by its first lines. So when you want to say Psalm 22, no one called it Psalm 22. They weren't numbered like that, not quite yet. It was, my God, why have you forsaken me? That psalm. That's what he's citing. Now, the emphasis here is on felt. You notice we've been saying this whole time, we feel abandoned by God. Spurgeon felt abandoned or forsaken. The psalmist feels forsaken. Jesus on the cross feels forsaken. And I think this is important because I remember last year in Matthew, there's a debate among the Bible college students that was Christ actually abandoned on the cross? And if you read it literally, you're like, well, yes, he said, why have you forsaken me? But you say, how can the Father and the Spirit abandon the Son? That would rupture the Trinity, right? Like, that's a conundrum. Like, well, that doesn't sound right either. Well, it's very simple when we remember that in his divinity, Christ was never severed from the Father. He was never severed from the Spirit. The eternal communion of the eternal Trinity remains. But in his humanity, he experienced the feeling of abandonment. And I'm emphasizing feeling because God does not abandon people. He told Joshua, I'll never leave you or forsake you. Jesus tells us at the Great Commission, granted it's after the cross, but he says, behold, I am with you to the end of the age. We feel abandoned. Christ also experienced the same thing we feel. But God never actually abandons. Did you know that what you feel is not always real? That's really important to know because part of spiritual warfare is to teach you that what you feel is reality. I don't feel like worshiping God. Then maybe you shouldn't, they say. Yeah, maybe I should take it easy. Maybe I should just binge some show instead. Nothing wrong with that. But when that's your answer to not wanting to worship God, you're losing the battle. Feel is not always real. That's something we need to know. Now, in addition to Jesus feeling moments like this psalm, look at verses 9 and 10. See what this evokes in your mind. Verses 9 and 10. Rescue me, O Lord, from my foes. To you have I fled for refuge. Teach me to do your will. For you are my God. That reminds me, if it doesn't remind you, of Matthew 26:38, when Jesus is in Gethsemane. Then he said to his disciples, my soul is very sorrowful, even to death. Sounds like the psalm, right? Remain here and watch with me. And going a little further, he fell on his face and prayed, saying, my Father, if it be possible, let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not as I will, but as you will. What's he doing? He's seeking refuge in the Lord. But he's also seeking his will. For it is in God's will that we find refuge. But in Psalm 143, we don't just see depression. We don't just see hopelessness and abandonment. We also see, you could see, and I think this makes sense too. You could see that this is Christ's resting in the tomb, awaiting resurrection. Psalm 143 is like Christ. He's in that place of despair because it's Saturday, right? Saturday is when he's in the tomb, awaiting resurrection. We know that there's refuge. We know that there will be victory, Psalm 143 says. But in the meantime, at least that's how Henry Patrick Reardon looks at Psalm 143. And he says, quote, almost every line takes on an enhanced poignancy in that context. Because God did not abandon Jesus in the grave. We know from Psalm 16, it says, you will not abandon my soul to Sheol. You will not allow my flesh to see corruption. We know that's talking about Christ, that that's his prayer, because in Acts chapter 2, Peter cites that psalm and says this was about Christ, that God, and then Peter, after citing that part of the psalm, then leaves a comment and says to his audience, God did not leave Christ in the grave, but raised him up. God will not abandon us. That's one thing that it teaches us. That if this reflects Christ waiting for his rescue, then guess what will happen to us? If God did not abandon him, he will not abandon us. That's one of the things Psalm 143 is teaching us. Because Christ said, I will never leave you or forsake you. Well, actually, I'm sorry, that was the Joshua one. But he says in Matthew 28, verse 20, behold, I'm with you even to the end of the age. Amen. End of the Gospel of Matthew. So, there's this tension. God does not abandon us, yet why do we feel abandoned? Why does he allow this to happen? On one hand, this could be our folly. We can do things that cause the heart to feel hardened toward God, and then we don't sense his presence. Perhaps that's one way to understand the opening of this psalm when it says, O Lord, to you, listen, O Lord, to my prayer. Turn your ear to my appeal, your faithful, your just give answer. Do not call your servant to judgment, for no one is righteous in your sight. Like, I know I'm not righteous, but please rescue me. maybe that's one way to read that. Or, where was I? Sometimes we feel that tension. Yeah, thank you. Because it's our folly, but sometimes we feel that tension because God uses cycles of mountaintop experiences and deep valleys to grow us into the people he wants us to be. Into the creatures, Lewis would say. The creatures he wants us to be. Or Lewis also says he wants us to stand up on our own feet. So he doesn't want babies, like Liam, that he carries around all the time. You've got to be born at some point. But there's a point when you want to see the child realize his potential and begin to walk and begin to now drive a vehicle. Well, most parents don't want to see that happen, nor do other drivers. Learn to cook food and make a living, right? You want to see potential reached. And God is the same way with us, his children. So one of the reasons is that God does this, he allows us to feel abandoned so that we then have to pursue him harder. We have to learn to fight the enemy, not without him, for he's with us. But sometimes he will make it not easy, because if everything's just easy, then you never grow. You have to be pushed a little bit and say, I may not feel like worshiping God, but I will. And then the muscles of the spirit and of the soul are strengthened. So, for example, you see this throughout scripture, like Israel is enslaved in Egypt. That's a low. Then they are rescued through the plagues. That's a high. And then they are cornered by the Red Sea in the coming Egyptian army. Like, that's a low. And then Moses parts the Red Sea. Like, that's a high. And they singing wonderful praise to God. And it seems like they're never going to stop. And then as we looked at Wednesday with the Buellers at their house, then they come to bitter water. God, what not? And they're like, you brought us out here to die. And they're all upset. That's another low. And then God heals the waters. Like, yay, God, he'll never curse us with the Egyptian diseases if we follow him. And then the next chapter, we're hungry. You brought us out here to kill us, Moses. And then there's manna. And then there's, you can keep going. Like, it ebbs and flows with, yay, yay, And it's the same throughout Scripture, right? David is anointed as the next king. Yay. And then he goes and kills Goliath. Yay. And then Saul wants to kill him. What? That's not how you're supposed to be rewarded. It just keeps going up and down. And our Psalms have done the same pattern. These six psalms, these six traditional morning prayers, go through these patterns to teach the Christian life. For example, just the last three. Psalm 88 was very dark and low. Psalm 103 was up on the mountaintop of the highest praise. And Psalm 143 brings us back down. This is what Lewis calls the law of undulation, or the laws of ups and downs. Here's how he puts it. I've noticed, you know, lately it's in Matthew class, it seems like it's not a class if I don't quote C.S. Lewis. Well, lately we've been quoting him, I feel like, every week here too. But this is what he says in the Screwtape Letters. I've cited this guy's in sermons so many times because it's just gold. But so remember, the demons are writing about us, and this is what they say. Sooner or later, God withdraws from us, if not in fact, at least from their conscious experience. So it's a felt abandonment, not an actual abandonment. And all those supports and incentives go away. Like the feeling that he's near, God's awesome. Like sometimes he'll withdraw all that. He leaves the creature to stand up on its own legs, to carry out from the will alone, meaning not the emotions, but from the will alone, duties which have lost all relish or lost all enjoyment. It is during such trough periods, low moments, much more than during the peak periods, that it, us, is growing into the sort of creature he wants it to be. Hence, the prayers offered in the state of dryness are those which please him best. The prayers in the state of dryness are those that please him best. Isn't this a great line in verse 6? To you I stretch out my hands. My soul is like a parched land before you. That's just so visual. The one who prays the psalm is like this, stretching out his hands because he is a thirsty, hungry land that is desperately ready to catch any rain that comes down. This prayer in this moment of dryness pleases God best. Why? Because it wasn't the reward of, I want to do this. It's the moment when we choose him, when it seems like he's not near, when we find no joy in it, when every other temptation in the world or distraction seems better than him. And yet we say, despite all this, I know who he is, even though I can't feel it or see it right now. That's the prayer that grows the saint. So how do we escape the dungeon of giant despair? Through prayer. Prayer is our key out of the dungeon of despair. C.S. Lewis, after saying that in a state of dryness, our prayer is what pleases him best, he then finishes up that little section with this. The demons are desperate here. Our cause is never more in danger than when a human, no longer desiring, but still intending to do our enemy's will, God's will, then looks around upon a universe from which every trace of him seems to have vanished and asks why he has been forsaken and still obeys. That's when they say their cause is never more in danger. So it can be a gift. When we have depression of spirit, when we are in the dungeon of giant despair, When we wonder or feel that God has somehow left us, forgotten us, abandoned us, forsaken us, left us to figure it out. That's really one of the best ways to understand the second verse. Do not call your servant to judge. Oh, I'm sorry, verse 1. You are faithful, you are just, give answer. This is not praying in our faithfulness. It's praying in his faithfulness. So prayer will heal or will rescue us from our despair. Prayer will rescue us from the dungeon of despair. There's three ways to pray, at least drawing from our psalm, that prayer can do this. So just pull three quick lessons here from this. Pray not in your own faithfulness, but in God's faithfulness. I unfortunately tipped my hand too early on that one. Pray not in your own faithfulness, but in God's faithfulness. So again, listen, O Lord, to my prayer. Turn your ear to my appeal. He doesn't say, I am faithfully praying, you must answer me. No, he's saying, you are faithful, you are just, give answer. I don't come before you in my own confidence. Actually, quite frankly, our confidence is often at an all-time low when we are in despair or in depression of spirit. And often we feel like our prayers amount to nothing. In fact, we feel like, who am I? And he instead, what we do in prayer is we recognize it's not my worth that matters in prayer. It's who he is. Prayer is meant to draw me into who he is, not to make him come and notice where I am or who I am. It's supposed to draw us to that rock higher than ourselves. So you are faithful, you are just. I feel like a miserable wretch. We know that because verse 2 says, do not call your servant to judgment, for no one is righteous in your sight. Like, I cannot depend upon who I am or what I've done. I'm at a place where I recognize I am a wretch and I mess up a lot. And I can't make two righteous deeds come together if my life depended on it. I can hardly desire to pray right now, Lord. So you're faithful and just. You give answer. I'm just here. It's the best I can do. Some commentators believe that when Paul in Galatians 2 verse 16 and Romans 3 verse 20 says that we are saved by grace. We are not, what he says, we're justified by faith, not by the works of the law. In both those texts, when he says we're justified by faith and not by works in the law, they actually think that Paul is drawing on this verse 2, for no one is righteous in your sight. And what he's doing is, of course, it doesn't talk about the law, but Paul is like re-exegeting the psalm and saying, look, no one is righteous in God's sight, not even those who do the works of the law. And that's really interesting because if there is like a foreshadow of justification in this verse, it all the more draws upon us in prayer not to depend upon who we are or on the words of our prayer, but simply by laying ourselves before God and saying, have mercy, you do what you will. Because I bring nothing to the table but need. I am a dry, parched land. So we pray not in our own faithfulness, but in God's faithfulness. Second, recall God's works. Recall God's works. What would David have been recalling? His victories over Goliath? His victories in battle? His son Absalom's after him, but hey, you sustained me through Saul. Like, you've done this, God. He could also go further back to the Exodus story that we just recounted a moment ago. God, this is what you do. And this is important, by the way, sorry, I'm drawing on verse 5 here. Verse 5 is where he talks about, I remember the days that are past and I remember your works. We dwell on these in these moments because we have to remember that when we feel forsaken, this is not reality because look what God has done in my life. Look what he's done in others' lives. Look what he's done in the history of the church and in the history of the Bible. Look how good he is. Because what happens in despair is despair's greatest lie is this is who you are for the rest of your life. There's no way out. Giant despair beautifully, ugly, but was depicted very accurately as telling those poor pilgrims, there is no hope for you. You might as well take your own life. We feel stuck and we must in prayer muse upon the works of God because this is who he is. I don't feel it and I don't see it, but I must believe that this is temporary. This is not going to be forever. And then third, so that was recall God's works in verse 5. Third is seek God's mercy in the morning. There's this anticipation in verse 8. In the morning, let me hear your loving mercy. Why? Why am I going to get up in the morning? Why am I going to let you hear my loving mercy? Why, when, if you're in despair, if you're in depression of spirit, you know what this feels like? You know that you don't want to get up and do something, especially something important. Why get up in the morning? Why ask God to pour his mercy upon you? Because in you, I place my trust. Do you trust him? Then demonstrate it. Get up in the morning. And that's so healing too, because sometimes in these low states, you don't want to get out of bed because you know there's nothing good for you in the day. Like, why hasten the day? Like, this, I want to stay here as long as possible. But the morning is when we hear his loving mercy. Lamentations 3, somewhere in chapter 3, says his mercies are new every morning. This is the time to drink in the mercy we need in these moments. Despair wants to keep us in prison, but getting up to pray for his mercy is our way out of prison. Yeah? So, to close, let's go back to the dungeon of giant despair. We left them Saturday morning when he had showed them the bones. That was it, yeah. Showed them the bones and said, this is going to happen to you. I suggest you take your life. And they laid there, it said, groaning all the rest of that day. But you know what happened at Saturday night? Saturday night at midnight, something happens. And Christian and Hopeful begin to pray through the night. They keep vigil. They watch. They pray through the night. Oh, this is going to be good. Like, this is what they needed to do. It reminds you, doesn't it, of Paul and Silas in their own dungeon as they praised and prayed through the night and God sent the earthquake. And here they are praying and seeking his loving mercy in the morning. It says that they pray until sunrise, and it was at sunrise. So what does that make it now? What morning is that? Sunday morning. Like Bunyan was so intentional here. Sunday morning, resurrection day. It dawns on Christian as they've prayed through the night. He says this, what a fool. What a fool I am to lie here in this stinking dungeon when I might walk free on the highway to glory. I have a key in my bosom called promise, which I am sure will open any door in Doubting Castle. And I can imagine Hopeful going, you had a what this whole time? But that is so true to where we are in despair. We don't see what we have, but that's why we push through in prayer. That's why we seek his loving mercy in the morning. That's why, if necessary, we push past the despair. We go through the darkness of night and keep praying. We keep vigil. We keep watch. And it is at the resurrection. By the way, 143 has in both, like, can you only refer to the traditional churches, because the Protestant Reformation is like 500 years old, right? So, like, you know, before that, the Catholic and Eastern Church used Psalm 143 every Saturday morning. It was Saturday morning prayer, anticipating the resurrection of Christ. And here they get the resurrection of Christ within them. Like, wait, there is life. Let's go out free. And so they escape despair through prayer. So will we escape the dungeon of giant despair through prayer? Or will we instead throw a pity party and make it more intolerable than it needs to be?